Hey folks, and tonight's episode is brought to you by YesPleaseVintage.com. If you're in the States and a fan of vintage and upcycled housewares and clothing, give YesPleaseVintage.com a check for clothing, jewelry, homeware, and some really awesome finds. So go check them out now at YesPleaseVintage.com. And currently, if you spend over $60, you get free shipping on all orders. Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello!
Tonight we look at Uncle Bunny, who can recall his past lives. But before we get into that and the fun and games of trying to pronounce the director's name, it's time to ask what you've been watching. And Stephen, what have you been watching since the last episode?
Okay, I've got a couple of things, both... older variety, but both things I haven't seen before. The first film is a Korean film from 1961 called Aimless Bullet, or Orbitan. Now, quite often you'll see these lists of the best Korean film of all time, yeah? And they'll say Parasite, or they'll say Old Boy, or they'll say The Housemaid, something like that. Well, actually, one of the other films in that is this Aimless Bullet film. This Aimless Bullet film, it sounds something completely different. And it's from a slightly different age of Korean cinema, sort of what they call like the Golden Age. So this post-Korean War, but pre sort of modern South Korea. So this South Korea is this country that basically, or Korea, I guess, was this country that spent centuries as like a hidden kingdom cut off from the outside world, although constantly repelling, you know, invaders from China and Japan. And then sort of before the Second World War was invaded by the Japanese and occupied by the Japanese. And a lot of Korean culture was pushed out, and there was a real sort of attempt to Japanify the Korean people and their culture. And then the Japanese lost the Second World War, but then the Koreans almost sort of fell immediately into their own civil war, which, and the country was then, you know, split into two, and there was Americans down south, and there were Chinese and Russians up north, and it sort of was in this state of very public war and occupation for a lot longer. So, you know, we often talk about sort of post-war Britain, don't we, and saying, well, in 1951 we were still having what's it called when we had to have tickets for food. I wasn't alive then. I make it sound like I was rationing around in 1950. I wasn't. Rationing's what I'm thinking of, yeah. Rationing was over by the time I was born. But I think there is this talk, you know, of that post-war austerity that went on past the war. But if you think about it, in Korea, it went on for even longer. And what they came out of, so they sort of went in from this sort of feudal system that hadn't really been touched by the 20th century in the way that many other countries have been, all the way through to like the early 1960s, to being sort of still being semi-occupied by the Americans. The country's been split in half. Anyway, Aimless Bullet is set in it's set in 1961, and it's basically the story of a family and their struggles in this sort of modern contemporaneous Korea. There's a couple of brothers. One of them who fought in the Korean War is a war hero, but he can't get a job. When he does get a job, it's in a film. This director wants him to basically be a war hero in a war film, but they only get him because of the wounds he's got. He's got like bullet wounds and stuff, so they want to glorify the things he went through. But I think, you know, many cultures. So think of a lot of that post-Vietnam films in America. You know, the soldiers come back, they've fought for their country, they've lost limbs, they've taken bullets, and then they can't get jobs. It's all very Deer Hunter, right? And very anything that Oliver Stone did in the 90s sort of thing. So this is going on. His brother, he works in an office, he's an accountant, but he's got a toothache, terrible toothache, but he can't afford to have the dentist to go and see him. Their sister, who can't get a job either, and she ends up basically becoming a prostitute for the American soldiers, and you know, ironically, she's the one who's got money at the end. The guy with the toothache, he's got a wife who's pregnant and is going to have children, and the family's mother is scarred by she's got like post-traumatic stress from bombs going off during the war, and she wakes up and screams out the same screams every night. It's a melodrama, so it's a very Korean film of its time, and it's unrelentingly dark. It's really good and it's really well acted, but it's unrelentingly dark. And what I will do, I'll just tell you a little bit of the movie to show you how dark it is. So the brother, who is an ex-war hero, decides the way to make a bit of money is rob a bank. Right, and so he puts together one of the most piss poor attempts to rob a bank I've ever seen. Runs out with the money, and he's running through these basically these warehouses. And this is just one scene, and he runs past somebody, and it's a woman with a baby with a papoose on her back. You know what I mean? Like tight cloth thing with a little baby, and she's hung herself. So she's dead. The baby's still alive, crying for its mother. That's just something he runs past. That's not even a character or a plot point. That's just set dressing. So I think that gives you an idea of just how deeply dark this film is. However, it's really good. The downside is I've promised to write a review on it for about a month now for Eastern Kicks, and I just haven't got round to it because I can't think of a way of positively talking about this movie. It might be one we'll come to one day, actually, mate, because it's on YouTube for free, as is a lot of sort of this era of Korean cinema, which is something we haven't touched. You know, we've very much gone for modern Korean cinema, sort of post-2000 Korean wave stuff. I think the earliest we went back was maybe Peppermint Candy, which was sort of one of the first. But this is from a different age. Lots of stuff that's worth finding there. I'd really recommend it, but boy, is it dark. Right, so that's Stephen's history lesson on Korea and post-war Korea. The other thing I watched, a lot more cheerful. So 88 Films have just put out a box set of the three Stephen Chow Fight Back to School films. And of course, Stephen's going to buy that because he loves Stephen fucking Chow. And up until really recently, yes, you've been able to get Shaolin Soccer, and you've been able to get Kung Fu Hustle, and a few other films have floated around Netflix and iTunes and stuff, but weird ones, yeah? Like The $60 Million Man or whatever it was called, and Justice My Foot. I don't think Fight Back to School. I've never noticed it on any of the streaming channels. And so this is a series I would say it's kind of second tier Stephen Chow. It's Wong Jing Stephen Chow rather than absolute stone cold classics. I watched the first film in the series, which apparently is actually probably the weakest, but it was a huge hit when it came out in 91 in Hong Kong. It was like the biggest selling Hong Kong film of the year. If you've seen 21 Jump Street, you'll get the plot. Basically, Stephen Chow plays a very capable but also flawed he's a police action guy, let's just say it like that, who at the beginning of the film you sort of watch him during some training exercise, and although he's all action and saves the girl at the end, all his colleagues die due to him being very selfish and not much of a team player. So he's going to get kicked out of the police force. But his commander has lost his gun, his favourite gun, whilst on a school visit. So he basically gets Stephen Chow's character to go back to school. And even though he's like 28, to pretend to be like, and again, remember with Asian schooling, they go to school much later. So I think he's meant to be like 17, 18. So basically going to the school and see if he can find out where this gun has gone. There also seems to be a sort of a gang problem, which is linked to the local triads. As he gets there, he finds out, well, two things happen. One is that the caretaker, played by Ng Mun Tat, as it often is in these kind of films, is also an undercover policeman who's basically, he's meant to be his helper there, who ends up having to pretend to be his dad. And of course he falls in love with he falls in love with one of the teachers, which played by Sharla Cheung, which she doesn't know that he's an undercover kid, but she does clearly in one of those things that can only happen in 90s Hong Kong cinema. It's a bit creepy when you think about it. she grows feelings for one of her students, but you know, we know he's 28, but she doesn't. So that's the setup. It's funny in parts. It's funny. It's very funny in parts, and it's got some great visual comedy. The playoff of Ng Mun Tat and Stephen Chow is always good value for money. Is it a little bit overlong? Even only at an hour 40, it does feel a little bit stretched. And it probably suffers from having too coherent a plot, if that makes sense. It could have done with a little bit, you know, like when we watch a Stephen Chow film, there'll be these weird movie pastiches that don't really seem to be anything to do with the main plot. There's not so much of that. It really is about...
There's a lot of Stephen Chow movies that I've yet to... I know from Beijing with Lovers recently got a re-release over here, so that's another one that I really need to get around to watching as well. Because for whatever reason, I think it was on Netflix for a brief period, and like everything, as soon as you go to watch it, it disappeared, so...
The From Beijing Love. I can't remember. That's another boutique label that's putting out. They're also, I think it's the same people that's putting out An Hui's Visible Secret. So it's a very, I could be wrong on that, but yeah, it's a great time if you're a Stephen Chow fan, because you've waited years for some of these things to be available. It's a nice upscale as well. You know, a lot of these Hong Kong, even if you've been able to watch them on YouTube and places like that, they're fairly blurry and look like they've been recorded off a dirty VHS. But these things look glorious, which comes with the downside that they weren't filmed on super high quality stuff. So you do begin to see the sort of the some of the amateurish stuff around the edges. The sound, the music is fucking dreadful. But yeah, no, it's good. So if I don't know if 88 Films have a streaming service, but or if they're linked up to any of them, but it's quite nice to see them. And obviously, with as always with 88 Films, they sort of box things up quite nicely. So that was good. How about yourself, sir?
For myself, I've seen a couple of things. First off, I watched two of the films in the recent Katsuhito that was put out by Fair Window Films. Starting with Sharkskin Man, Peach Hip Girl. This one's his debut from 1998. He's kind of a quirky director, to say the least, and his films sort of capture a lot of the randomness of like the Miike DTV era. It's a lot of the plot lines, they have some really out there moments, and at the same time, some really colourful characters. Now, a lot of people say that he was the director of Redline, which is a really fantastic anime, when he was actually just a writer for that one. But he did also direct Funky Forest and The Taste of Tea. And he did, as I say, he directed this film, and he also directed Party 7, which was the other film for the box set I watched. Starting with Sharkskin Man, Peach Hip Girl. This one was obviously his debut film, and it follows this Yakuza who's on the run. He's stolen a bunch of money, and he hooks up with a girl who works at a hotel, and the pair end up going on the run while his former Yakuza mob are basically trying to track him down. It's a interesting film, but as I said, it's sort of loses its way in the second half. It really doesn't have the sort of pacing that I wanted from it. And while there's a whole bunch of really insane and random characters in this, it just never really sort of like, it never really sort of makes full use of the setup, really. Thankfully, when we get onto Party 7, things are a lot tighter. And this one also ties into one of my other favorite things, which is a one-room setup. As, again, another Yakuza on the run with money of his employers, is holed up in a hotel room. And over the course of the film, various people are going to visit him. His ex, the hitman, sent to find him, and then the hitman sent to take them all out. His ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend. And all the while, they're being watched by two peeping Toms, one called Captain Banana, and he's got his new protege, who is learning the trade of being a peeping Tom. And Captain Banana has not only set up this hotel so he has his own private peeping room, which is like, as I said, it's like almost like a superhero hideout, the way he's sort of set this thing up. As the film goes on, you kind of waiting to see who of them is going to make off with this this case full of money that he's got. This is a really wacky comedy. As I said, this is a whole bunch of wacky characters in a really wacky situation, and just seeing how they interact with each other as each of them present themselves as one thing, and over the course of the film their sort of secrets are like stripped away and we get to discover the real them. And it's, as I said, there's some real sort of wacky moments in it, including one of the characters who's been working in a department store as the test camera gets found that he's been taking dirty photos on the test camera, leading to a rather interesting conversation with his boss. We have a hotel that is run by odd characters, and the opening opens with our main character taking probably one of the most prolonged pisses since I've watched Fritz the Cat, because he's one that like starts off long and then it just goes way past weird. Kind of like if you watch the video for Window Licker by Aphex Twin, and how long that stretch limo goes on, and yep, it goes past the part where it's funny and just becomes really weird.
Yeah,
that's basically what you get with this this urinating scene. You're just standing there and he's going, I'm so weird. And you're just listening to him pee away for like a good 5 minutes. Classic. So, but I would recommend Party 7 out of the box set of the two that I've seen. You can also watch some on the Arrow player, so if you don't want to pay out for a box set, then you can obviously check it out on there and then go buy the box set. Because I think, as I said, Party 7 is definitely my favourite of the two films of his I've watched. So
yeah, it's not a director I've ever really followed, known about. I haven't seen any of the films. You kind of hear of them. I thought the box set of 50 quid was for total punts was probably just a bit too much for me. Maybe I need to investigate.
But first time they've been released in the UK, like a lot of fair women. I mean, yes. Yeah. They're very good at like getting those titles that never been released, like Crazy Thunder Road.
Yeah. To be fair to Third Window Films, they do specialise in the sort of quirky Japanese stuff. And I've got quite a lot of their films, but it's not a label it's not one of my go-tos. I also just have to correct myself, by the way. From Beijing Love is coming out from Eureka, so it's hardly a fucking boutique label. And okay. Visible Secret is Radiance, which is a bit more boutique, but they've also done A Moment of Romance, so which is another one of our past episodes. But yes, sorry, Third Window. I've got a few, but they always seem to be a bit on the quirky side.
Yeah, because they put out Peppermint Candy, which we've watched on the show, and they put out Fish Story, and they also put out Tales of Surprisingly Fast Swimmers. So we've done a few Third Window films.
Oh, indeed. I'm just looking down at my collection now, and obviously they are incredibly tied up with Terracotta and one of the other ones. I can't remember, but 88? No, I don't think it is 88 films. It's someone else. It doesn't matter. But, you know, they are. It's great because they're giving us these kind of indie films or the quirky films. So it's nice not to just get Takashi Miike and Sion Sono movies, which seems to be what a lot of the other people, the other labels seem just to be obsessively pumping out or doing it on the star power. So it sounds kind of cool. If I get a short subscription, that sounds like I might check some of these films out.
Yeah, I think it's definitely good for that. No, we got asked on the site, I think it was Marcus who asked us about the release for Evil Dead Trap, which I keep seeing someone, I'm sure that it's Arrow who are going to be putting it out. I know certainly on the Arrow Player, if you can get access to the US catalogue, you can watch it on there. But at the moment, as far as I could tell, other than the original DVD release of Evil Dead Trap 1 and Evil Dead Trap 2, which have got that sort of VHS fuzziness to it that a lot of like the DTV releases had back in like the 2000s, when you had some like the second tier labels releasing stuff. So I haven't seen the Blu-ray, but there is a Blu-ray of both the first film and the second film that is available, which I believe is just a region one. But if you've got multi-region Blu-ray player, then you can pay out the £25 to get that.
Yeah, I was just having a look. I can't see. I thought I'd seen that there was a release of it, but no, I can just see.
I think I've got to start saving the release posters so I can tell, because they always put out the release poster like at least 2 to 3 months ahead of them releasing things.
What Arrow do, for sure. Yeah.
They have their announcement. It's like in October, and you've normally forgotten because you're in June.
They do, and people get very excited. They put the poster out, and then you on the Facebook, and you see some of the people we know are writing on there as well. Mr. Brooks has always got something to say about it, and
Mr. Brooks says,
but there's always this tension between what Arrow put out in the UK and the US. So there's always someone moaning that something hasn't been put out in their territory. And there's always...
Oh, it's the same for the Arrow player as well, because they have stuff that goes onto the US catalogue and sort of vice versa, that we'll get stuff the US won't. It's always a point of contention. And they're always so nice about it when you like... When you have your little gripe, it's sort of like, oh, we're sorry, we're trying to get the rights. you end up apologising to them for daring to like question the catalogue. Oh,
absolutely. You know, you just think, we don't really know what goes into it. You know, securing the rights and then arranging remasters and...
No, because we just like live in this world where, you know, we should have a universal catalogue. We shouldn't have like a US catalogue and a UK catalogue. The same, and I mean, this isn't just Arrow. I mean, this is like on
Netflix and
Shudder.
These VPN companies are making a fortune out of this feature, aren't they? Oh, you can't watch this, but if you pretend you're in Canada, you'll be able to watch every bit of it. And you just think, yeah, but there are genuine reasons why it is the case. All due to people wanting to make money out of films and where they sell the rights. But it is incredibly frustrating. And I do feel sorry for some poor kid who's getting paid tuppence halfpenny for being the Arrow Films Twitter and Facebook poster, social media manager. And they're just getting shit every month.
It's the same three people as well.
Yeah, I haven't noticed you as one of the. Some people are really quite rude.
Well, what's he going to really achieve by me being rude?
I know.
Because it doesn't change anything. You can voice your frustration. But if you're rude, I mean, what's it going to change me, like, flipping out some guy over Twitter?
I know. It reminds me, have you ever seen on YouTube those, like, a band will put out the video for their new single, and underneath it, there'll always be someone saying, come to Brazil. you can just guarantee. And it's, you know, it's genuine fans of that band that think the band are going to be watching their own YouTube videos to read the comments, because I guess not every band goes to Brazil, right? No, a lot of them do. But it's just it never says come to Slovenia or come to Jakarta. It's come to Brazil. And I just think it's hilarious, and bless them. And then I begin to think, maybe it's not genuine. Maybe this is just a thing that people do. But they all look like, from their names and stuff, that they are genuinely from Brazil. But yes, social media is funny. It's just these sort of things that go on. And then other things post, and no one comments it at all. And you think, well, why did anyone bother? Oh, dear. But yes, please, We'll have to do that, won't we? One month. Shall we do as one of our episodes? We'll deliberately go and have a look at the Arrow release for that month and comment underneath it, and we'll see all our audience.
We're starting to include it in the rundown of what's coming up.
Yeah,
we'll make a note and start cutting them out.
Because I do like it because it is one of the labels that I don't follow a lot of labels, but that is one that I do. And I'm and not just for Asian cinema or even world cinema, but they put out all kinds of interesting stuff.
But as I said, we always do share like the release and we share the trailer video for Arrow Player each month. So if you go onto any of our socials, we're on Facebook, we are on Twitter. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Threads, and we're also on Blue Sky.
Oh, are we now?
We are. Again. So thank you to Emily at the Feminine Critique for hooking us up with that, because we are not social media movers and shakers to get.
And let's just be totally honest about it. I'm just going to pull the curtain back again. Elwood does all that stuff. He edits the show. He does all the reposting.
I sing the theme tune.
I just turn up every Friday and talk. And sometimes I repost, but I'm so hopeless. I think I'm just reposting as Asian Cinema Film Club half the time and doubling up. I am not social media savvy.
You're like Matt Damon's contribution to the Good Will Hunting script.
I will quite happily say that you are Ben Affleck and I am Matt Damon. I think if I'd be quite happy taking that credit, mate.
So have you seen the Family Guy skit where Ben Affleck's there writing it? So like, I finished my script, Good Will Hunting, is Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon's lying on the couch. He's like, hey, can I put my name on that? And he's like, well, picture your line, and he just farts at him.
But yeah, I am not very social media savvy, which probably explains why my Instagram is so useless.
I'm also got back into One Piece.
Okay.
So watching that, I'm still on the first arc, so don't expect any startling revelations unless you've also just started One Piece. But we just had Sanji join the crew, who's the cook, and we're going on to the fishmen village at the minute. So that's it. As I said, I chip away at it. It's just unfortunate the fact that on Crunchyroll they only got sub for it. A lot of the shows now have got dubs as well, but it's so hard to like just sit there and just watch sub after sub episodes, because I tend to fall asleep. So been trying to chip away at it and get a few more episodes on, so hopefully we'll be a bit further along next time we record. But I've not seen the live action, although I've heard good things, and I know it's got a season 2 now, unlike Cowboy Bebop, which got cancelled after 1.
All I know is that my PlayStation 5 keeps trying to pimp it to me.
Yeah.
When you go to media, it gets One Piece and go, oh, hello. Has Elwood been on here?
I don't know. The pirate rap from Fox Kids is stuck in my head for no apparent reason. It's complete. Because I said on Crunchyroll you get the original theme, but as I said, for some reason I still got the Fox Kids pirate rap version stuck in my head for some reason. Every now and again I'll just hear the hey ho, hey oh, or he had a piece of fruit and a gum gum tree. So anyway, that's other than that, I keep flicking out other series. I've watched other stuff on there. I can't remember. There's a bunch of stuff I remember. I keep like looking at picking up, like getting back. I've got a bunch of shows which I'm like partway through them. Like I'm in season 3 of Food Wars, which I need to get back into. Like Sword Art Online, I need to get back into because I'm on the second or third season of that as well. So, and I'm still like got Demon Slayer, which I started as well. So, and then we've got the final season of Attack on Titan coming up, so it's just all piling up. But
this is why I don't do anime.
And you, every you know, every quarter we get a new season of anime that you've got to watch.
I have ultimate respect for people who are all over it. I just do not know how anyone has enough time.
Well, you know that 12 hours that you spend like just playing video games.
Well, I wish I did, but
yeah. You know, when if you took like the time that you put into like StarCraft or Pong or Invader or whatever you're playing, and then you would have like some anime time. You could like scratch off 2 episodes per hour of game time.
I agree. I think if you're an anime fan, you cannot possibly have any other hobbies. I just think that's taken.
What, watching anime, subscribing to anime, dressing up as anime,
the cosplaying and posting on Reddit about anime, creating memes with anime characters that apparently I'll never understand. Yeah, I think it's a lifestyle choice. It's not just a media consumption.
You know, there's a part of me though, you know, being the embittered xenial that I am, that it's all now too easy. Because back in the day, you had to like know people to get your anime. You had to like know bootleggers, and you had people who were like doing fan subs, and you had to hunt stuff down. And now you just like go into Crunchyroll or Funimation or High Dive, and you can get all the anime you want. And it's often like within an hour of being shown in Japan. So it's pretty insane world that we now live in.
I mean, it is. It's a bit like, you know, I always feel we're chipping away at some part of the internet, of cinema culture, that, you know, we're not renegades, but we're on the fringes. And then someone's like, "Oh, Stephen, I saw Parasite the other day," and you think, what? And then I was in
elitist now.
I was in. Well, no, I don't mind at all. It's just weird that. Some of these things are so mainstream, and the most mainstream thing of all is that when you go into a bookshop, yes, they do still exist, everybody. So I went into Waterstones in Reading the other day to buy something for my nephew for his birthday, and the manga section, which I know it isn't anime, but you know, same sort of thing, certainly where One Piece comes from, right? So the manga section is bigger than the science fiction section in Waterstones Reading by quite some way.
And oh wow.
And there's always people there. Yeah. Bookshops have gone a little bit out of vogue, right? People can just go into bookshops to buy gifts. Hey, it's what I was there, don't they? So they'll go in the beginning and they'll buy the new Jamie Oliver cookbook for mum, or the new John Grisham or something to take on holiday. You don't see a lot of people in the depths of the bookshop looking at all the other books, yeah,
like Tom of Finland books and stuff.
But in the manga section, which is 4 shelves big and a little alcove, which isn't a particularly well stocked manga selection, I don't think. There's always 3 or 4 people there, and they're always talking about it and really excited about it. I obviously get library vibe and think, "Why are you talking in the bookshop?" But of course you can talk in a bookshop. It's not a library, yes. You should be able to do a song and dance number if you want to. I don't know why I get all weird about it. But yes, I just find it interesting that 20 years ago, where would you buy your manga? You'd have to go to Forbidden Planet or something, right?
Yeah. You'd say go to Forbidden Planet and you would import things like you would normally pay premium price to get copies of Shonen Jump. So you could find out what's happening with Goku and his pals.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a bit more than 20 years ago, because I'm guessing late 90s. the manga was actually quite a big thing. And
obviously, well, that was the thing, because it was like anime was like, from where I remember it, it was like anime came over, and obviously it was through Manga Entertainment, which is why, as Brits called it, manga, and the Americans called it Japanimation. And obviously, you know, the actual manga came a lot later. I don't remember really seeing manga until like the 2000s. And as I think it was always like in places, as you said, like Forbidden Planet, and that they would have like the section jammed upstairs for all the that sort of thing. And now it's like a much bigger section, as you said, and you can get all your Funkos of your favorite characters.
Well, I did go to Forbidden Planet in London the other day, about 2 months ago, and I used to go very regularly. It used to be like every other weekend I'd get on the train to London and go and buy my comic books. And Forbidden Planet wasn't necessarily my first stop, but it was part of my rotation that I'd go through at least once a month, if not twice a month. And I hadn't really been there since it moved. I think it's on Shaftesbury Avenue now, isn't it? When it used to be somewhere else. And I was shocked and devastated to find out that at least one half of that shop is just Funko Pops.
Yeah, pretty much.
It is just Funko. And there are normal Funko Pops and giant ones and tiny ones. And as you say, there are Funko Pops for popular media, popular culture things that I've never heard of, which I assume most of them are manga and anime and computer games as well. The ones that you see in HMV and sort of Tesco's and places like that don't even scratch the freaking surface of what's available. And I was, it's just rows and rows of these dead-eyed, big-headed things looking at you.
I found a Carrie Funko today, but it's in like luminous paint.
Yeah,
and I thought if they'd had like a normal paint job, with hair with the blood and stuff, I thought that would have been pretty cool. But that and Pennywise, I keep stumbling across. So,
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm as guilty of owning Funko Pops as anybody, right? Emily sent me a Barbie one. So I've got a Barbie one, I've got my Baby Metal ones, I've got lots of sort of my favourite Marvel character ones. But yeah, these are dark, not dark, they're not dark corners of the internet, I'm just not aware of it. I'm sure there are One Piece Funko Pops, right? And I know what One Piece is.
Name of the treasure.
I've got One Piece computer games and my Bandai Wonder Swan. I was on One Piece before I even knew it, and I went to a One Piece exhibition in Hong Kong, so I'm all over One Piece. But that's just that I've heard of that. There's the ones who don't even have the name translated into something English. That's the hardcore fans, isn't it?
Oh, the thing is, like, everything's like they give like the Japanese name things, so they're just really off. Which is always like really embarrassing when you work on an Asian symbol. can't pronounce anything. Although I did enjoy, obviously, with the re-release of Vogue Boy, being able to talk about the Vengeance trilogy, because a lot of people haven't actually seen anything other than Old Boy. I've been finding out. No, everyone's sort of like, they may have seen Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, but very few people have seen Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance.
Oh, barely anybody's seen it. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's like I was saying earlier, I've seen a Korean film. What Korean film have you seen? It's going to be Parasite or Old Boy. That's the two you can guarantee 9 times out of 10. But that's cool, you know. I think it's really exciting that people are seeing them. But it does possibly give a impression that Korean cinema is just like that, whereas they are very. And Train to Busan. And millions of people have seen Train to Busan, but we need to cover that on the show at some point.
We do. Certainly, we got the 31 Days of Asian Horror as well coming up. So a lot of fun things that we're going to get pretty crossed off over the course of that season as well. So I've got a rough list that I'm working from at the minute. And obviously, we've been getting recommendations for the socials as well. So thank you to everyone who sent that. And we'll also be revealing at the end of this episode the film that we are going to be covering for our Halloween pick this year as well. So,
exciting. That's a look forward to. Because it gets revealed to me at the same time.
But that is all I've got to really report from my vague anime watching and obviously the box sets from Fair Window Film. So on that note, it's time to fire the projector for tonight's feature presentation, which is Uncle Boon Lee, who can recall his past lives. So Uncle Boon Lee, who can recall his past lives, released in 2010, a first Thai movie to win at the Cannes Film Festival. And it's a film that I feel was kind of like dropped off the radar for a lot of people since its release. When it came out in 2010, had a lot of buzz behind it. Tarantino named it as one of his favourite films of the year. But Fenton is one of those films that I never actually got around to seeing. I had it on like my love film list and Cinema Paradiso list, and I just never got to see it. And it's never, for one reason or another, it's never filtered through onto like any of the film channels either. So it was good to finally watch it, because this was your pick, Stephen.
It was my pick, and I think it was something that was always going to come up. So when I did, when I was much more able to do writing before I, you know, before we started this podcast, I used to write and interview and do a lot more work for EastonKicks.com than I do now. And my thing, my area of specialisation was Thai slow cinema. And director Apichatpong Virasethakul, there we go. It's the only time I'm going to say it, because he likes to go by Joe, which is going to make it a lot easier for all of us. But he is like the, I don't know, the godfather of that movement. And a lot of the directors that I was reviewing their films, or even being lucky enough to interview them, they were inspired by him or worked alongside him as sort of second unit directors and editors and things like that. So this, so his whole sort of cinematic CV, which isn't vast, is kind of at the epicenter of that. And I'm ashamed to admit I've never seen this film before, even though I'm very aware of the director and his other films. So I was kind of interested to see it. I knew that it's going to be a very different kind of film to what we normally cover. I know I often bring things up, like I did The Assassin, and obviously, you'll never let me forget The Terrorizers. So I really always get very fearful when I bring something like this up. So I'm fascinated to find out what you think about it.
Yeah, this is certainly an interesting film, and it's one that certainly got our listeners excited over on the socials. We we'll obviously go into some of those reviews in a bit later, but the film itself is a very visual-driven film, and it certainly ties into that genre of slow Thai cinema, certainly. The film itself following Boon Lee, who has chosen to spend his final days surrounded by his loved ones in the countryside, where he suffers from acute kidney failure. At the same time, he starts being visited by ghosts of his family that have passed, including his dead wife and a long-lost son who's returned in a rather non-human form, to say the least. At the same time, he's also flashing back to his previous lives, which includes a very interesting story about a princess and a catfish, which may also make it the only film to win the Cannes Film Festival for that scene alone.
Yeah, it's a kind of quite dreamy film. It's not just slow. Often in sort of these slow cinemas, they're quite usually very realistic, actually. And they're very often very urban. And they're all about the ennui of modern life. and or maybe about the loss of the innocence of the past and that kind of thing. This is a meditation on life and family and death, and is it wasn't the film I was expecting. I certainly wasn't expecting a little interlude with the princess and the catfish. That was came from nowhere. And then I even think the cover. I mean, I don't know how you watched it, but there's a Blu-ray put out by somebody. I haven't got my glasses. New Wave Films, and it's basically got that scene from quite early on, from the opening scene with the. What we later find out to be his son as some kind of monkey spirit, because he fucked another monkey spirit and he became one himself. So it's like this shadowy creature with these little red eyes.
Yeah, that was very much the big promo shot that they used on Everything, really, wasn't it? So
which has almost nothing to do with the vast bulk of the film, and makes it look like it's going to be some sort of creepy horror movie vibe. But actually, everyone takes the events, the appearance of ghosts, the appearance of the monkey spirit boy, and various other things just in their stride. And I do worry that there's things going on in this movie and there's references being made to things that are very particularly Thai culture, things that they'd understand. You know, like sometimes when we'd watch a film and we're getting that it's a riff on a Bible story. Or something like that. I just wonder if there's a whole bunch of stuff going on here that I have no idea what the reference is. And I'm enjoying it because it's all kind of dreamy and interesting and sometimes surreal. And sometimes, like, cinematically spectacular. You know, like when they go into those caves.
Yes.
That's just amazing. But I'm not going to lie to you, mate. I didn't really understand the film.
Well, certainly with the film, it's a very slow meditation on life, and it certainly talks about karma as well, because Mooney feels that his illness is linked to the fact that, you know, he killed communists while he was serving in the military, and as well the fact that he's even like links killing bugs on his farm as being things that have affected his karma, and this is the reason that he's now suffering from kidney failure. And we can obviously like try and read into this film, and I think it's not the easiest film to like try and break down either, but certainly it's the way that it took it was, is about this man who is really coming to terms with his own mortality, and in doing so that he's been visited by the people who have been important parts in his life, like, as I said, his wife who's passed, and she visits them, and the fact they're all around the family dinner table when these people visit, and was the initial shock there. There's also that familiarity to them, because they recognize these as people of their family, even when, as you said, the son turns up as the weird monkey man. And this is before we even get into the flash forward of the future vision, where we've got the guy in the gorilla suit being carried around by the chain by the military guys.
Yeah, so that I do have a view of what maybe that's about. So obviously Bumi talks about he's fought against communists and killed men, and I think there is a world in which these people, because there seems to be lots of these monkey spirits around.
Yeah, it becomes like Princess Mononoke at the end when they go to the cave and you can see them in the trees. It reminded me of the apes in Mononoke.
And I think that is kind of suggesting that there are these people who went over to the communist side. Like, I think that's what happened to his son, right? His son hasn't died. His son just has left his life because he probably went over and went to the communist side. So he's seeing those as these kind of monkey spirits, but they're everywhere, and he's seeing a future where a darker regime is kind of taking it does look a bit like Planet of the Apes, but it's all done in like stills, isn't it? It's kind of really fascinating. I mean, again, I'm doing my normal and bouncing all over the place, so sorry listeners and sorry Elwood for this, but you know, every segment of the film is shot in a slightly different way, so some of it's like an overly prosaic soap opera. Some of it shot like a documentary. That sequence I was just talking about is a series of stills. and although it's still got the same kind of indie cinema, it's incredibly well made. And it's only like when I sort of rewatched it, I noticed, oh yeah, every sequence is filmed in a different manner. And I, you know, you've got to be right. It is a meditation on death and what that means. But I think without that context of being Buddhist, maybe some of it gets lost on us. Maybe the catfish and the princess tale is a famous Buddhist story. We just haven't come across it before.
I'm just reading for the Wikipedia here of like the catfish section. Because it does come out of nowhere. It feels very disconnected from anything else in the film. Even the still section, the flash forward, seems more connected than this catfish sequence.
Yeah.
And, yeah, basically we have this princess who's being carried through a forest. And she's kissed by one of her servants and... She insists that she imagined kissing her reflection, and she ends up having this conversation with a catfish who says if you traded jewelry, then, you know, he'd be able to be made in her reflection. And then we have the catfish intercourse scene, which felt nothing to do with anything at all. But
and let's just be very clear to those of you who haven't seen it. When we talk about a catfish, we're not talking about someone who goes on Tinder and pretends to be a model and forms a relationship with you that you completely fall sucker for. We're talking about a literal fucking catfish.
Oh yeah, this isn't like a, you know, like a humanoid catfish. This isn't like a, you know, like a merman or something like that. No, this is just an actual catfish that we see trying to burrow it into her nether regions.
Yeah.
The Wikipedia calls it intercourse. I wouldn't. But both parties seem to enjoy themselves, and I'm just going to say, well, you do you. I don't know what was supposed to be going on, and I wish I was at calm when when they gave this one. It's all like, when they were voting for this, it's like, you really want to get the catfish movie this?
Yeah, I just can't help thinking that it's an implementation of a well-known story, and maybe perversion of it. I don't know, but yeah, there's something going on. But you don't forget it, right? And obviously they couldn't put that on the cover, so they went with the monkey spirit with the glowing red eyes, and maybe hoping to catch some of the Star Wars audience thinking it was a Jawa or something.
Oh my God.
I don't know, but I've found that I'm quite glad we're recording this episode, because the way I work is when I watch it, I leave it on my desk so I can remember to think about it in the lead up. And this little fella's been staring at me with his little red eyes all week. Well, actually, for 2 weeks, to be fair. It's giving me nightmares. It's not even scary in the film. It's just a creepy image that I'm finding.
It's quite disturbing. Fun, the Exorcist episode Detour, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's exactly one of the things that it's reminding me of. But in the film, I mean, that's a lovely scene in itself. You know, Boomy, we get introduced to him. We get introduced to his carer and his sister-in-law, who's sort of come to look after him. So he's it's a bit confusing because they keep talking about this guy from Laos. But he's the chef, isn't he? Who later on becomes a monk. But let's not worry about that. But there's a guy who's come to look after him. No. The guy from look after him is from Laos, isn't it? It's the chef that isn't. And, you know, we see a scene which is quite touching where he's having his dialysis done and so on and so forth. But they're just at dinner, talking away. And then the ghost of his ex-wife turns up. And they're just so wonderfully matter-of-fact about it. You know, this is his ex-wife, his dead wife, and it's her sister, and they just deal with it as if ghosts turning up for dinner is a normal thing.
But at least they bother to act shocked when these characters first appear. There is that initial panic, which is reassuring to the audience, because otherwise it's sort of like, oh yeah, it's a
minor shock, and then Monkey Boy comes in, and I think we can call him Monkey Boy without being racist. Monkey Boy comes in, who we have seen in an earlier, in the opening thing with the water buffalo. We've sort of seen him around. Comes in, and then actually he's less impressive when the light shines on him. But then hilariously, because it doesn't look very effective, the fella from Lao comes in, and he is fucking shocked. He's going, "What the fuck's going on here?" And that Monkey Boy goes, "Oh, the light's hurting my eyes. Can you turn the light off a bit so we don't have to see the terrible makeup?" That is genius. But yeah, they deal with it. But we've talked before, certainly in Hong Kong films, about Asian culture's relationship with death is very different to a Western, you know, in a Westerner's relationship with death. You know, for them, the concept of afterlife, the concept of rebirth and karma and the cycle of life is very different. We see death as the end, and it's, you know, it's a farewell and a goodbye. But they very much have these concepts of life is just the life on earth is just one step on a longer journey. So maybe Thai people see dead people all the time.
Mm. Now, you said the director likes to go by the name of Joe. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but he's quite a multicultural person, and he understands that most people in the film industry, because he's well regarded around the world, right? You know, as you said, you know, this film was recommended by Tarantino, and he's got lots of fans around the world. But he realizes that Achatipong is probably a little bit hard for most people, so let's just go by Joe. He's a pretty cool dude.
Well, apparently the book that the film was based on was an actual guy called Boom Ni, who could recall his past lives while meditating, because he was an abbot of the local Buddhist temple. And basically this led to the book called A Man Who Can Recall His Past Lives, which was put out in 1983. And by the time Joe came to the book, unfortunately Boomy had died, and he originally set out to like put this into like a biographical film about Boomy, but in the end he ends up like abandoning it to create the film that we have now, which still uses the book's structure and its content, but it's more in like a inspiration. And a lot of the production design choices are sort of inspired by old TV shows and comic books. And that's probably why the film goes off in its weirder directions, I feel.
I think you're right. I think it's what I was saying at the beginning. I think there's a lot of context, cultural context, we just don't understand, right? And I think people will say, "Oh, that's just like that film we watched," or "That's just like that, whatever the Thai word for manga is." And I think we're missing it. So I think there's a load to unpack that we don't have the tools to unpack. You know, and sometimes like when we watch a Hong Kong movie or something, you know, I'll know about it, or if it's about something else, you might know about it. But I just think this is a culture that maybe neither of us are terribly well informed about. And what I'd really like is if things like the Blu-ray had a bit more on it to help me out, because I was reading a lot of Letterboxd reviews and things, and lots of people really love this film. Very few people hate it.
Oh, you got a very popular response when we announced we were going to be covering this on the socials. So yeah, there's a lot of people saying that, you know, they really like this one. So
yeah, or at least his films in general. You know, maybe they prefer Cemetery of Splendor or whatever. But yeah, absolutely. But I always find Letterboxd to be an interesting, because some people seem to watch and review films that they didn't know what they were going to watch. Sometimes reviews can be very polarised. You think, how did you fall upon this film and watch it to the end and decide to write about it on Letterboxd? But yes, so it's confused a lot of people. But at the same time, it's got its fans. And I think, you know, most people are sort of saying it's a meditation on life and death and love and all those kind of things, which, let's face it, most films are in some way, shape or form. But I didn't feel there were a lot of people, and I guess Letterboxd, I can only read English, so if there were people writing Thai reviews on there, I wouldn't have seen it or understood it. But I would love if there is somebody who is from the Buddhist faith or from Thailand that could give us a 10-minute tracy of the things that we don't understand, because I think it would help me like the film even more. I've never felt so ignorant, Elwood.
I mean, I'm glad that I finally got to watch it, because I think it's one of those films that's always been sort of lingering in the background, but it's, without having this show, it's sort of like another of those films that you like constantly put off because you're waiting for the right time and mood and, you know, celestial patterns to be in the sky for you to watch it, and it's just sometimes easier to just go watch something else than something that's going to require you to think. But no, as I said, we've said already, I mean, it's certainly got its fans. Our friends over at Token Homo proclaimed it's one of my all-time favourites, A Total Love Affair. Chris Evans on Facebook has said, groundbreaking movie, it has some interesting ideas, but its title is still the best thing about the movie. And then someone pointed out the catfish scene. and you mentioned already about Symmetry of Splendor, which has already been recommended by Rashmi as well, who we will be getting on the phone at some point to perhaps explain this, because she's normally she's normally more clued in on these things than we are. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, please let us know. Let me know, because I hate it. You know, normally I do a fair bit of digging around and investigation and try to understand these things to why. That's why I get called the professor, right? But
you're the one who knows things.
In this case, I don't, and I want to, because I really liked this, but I think I could really like it even more.
Oh yeah, I feel that on the surface level, it's still really enjoyable, even if you're not fully sort of clued up on what's going on. I think the visual style of the film really keeps it appealing, and even when it goes off on its more bizarre tangents, they're still interesting enough to sort of like engage you. It doesn't sort of like push you away as an audience. By sort of like, you know, leaving you to sort of figure it out. I think it still manages to do a bit of hand-holding there, and like, say, like a Lynch film, which just like throws ideas at the screen and says, yeah, there's some weirdness for you to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll reiterate that scene where they go into the caves, which seems to be sort of some representation of Bumi's final night on Earth, because he's dead at the end of it, isn't he? It's just fucking spectacular without being ostentatious or anything. It's not flashy, it's just so well done.
And this is the where I started thinking, like, you know, the catfish scene with the princess, because we see catfish in the cave, and this sort of like has this idea of like going back to where he started. And does this to say that Bumi was the catfish in the previous life,
or was he the child that was made from their union? Because he talks something, he tells that he was born in that cave, doesn't he? But again, is he talking in is he being literal, or is this because he remembers being born in one of his lives in this cave? And you know, I didn't know that it was based on a sort of a book about a real character. You've done better Wikipedia reading than I have. So again, I will definitely, in a year's time, I'll come back to this movie, mate, and I'll probably understand it better.
I'm sure if we went to Mumbai, we'll find like some academic reading that will be like completely nothing how we've read the film.
Oh, I'm sure the Thai movie industry's got a PDF for us somewhere that I mean, actually there are some actually quite good. BFI do some quite good books on cinemas of various countries. I don't know if they've done one on the cinema of Thailand. The problem with the cinema of Thailand is it's quite either. I mean, I remember one of the first films we did was the Black Tiger, cowboy.
Tis the Black Tiger.
Tis the Black Tiger. That's right. And that is riffing on films that don't even exist anymore. You know, it's unfortunately the nature of the country has meant that, you know, that there's whole reams of its cinema and its history which have disappeared. And Achapong is, or Joe is sort of one of the directors that's actually broken out. There's a lot of commercial cinema out of Thailand, and obviously, you know things like Ong Bak and things like that. Yeah, that have the genre films that have, you know, exceeded the boundaries of Thailand. But I think it's one of the cinemas that doesn't have that great global reach. I don't think anything... Can I call it Indochina? That peninsula? I don't know what we're allowed to call it anymore. But that Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos area of the world have very strong cinema, but I don't think it has the reach of other Asian markets at all. And I think our show shows that. How many Thai films have we done? Three?
I'd say yes, that sounds right. I mean, we did... Let's see, we did Chocolate, Tears of the Black Tiger.
And this. I think they're the three.
And there may be another one in there somewhere.
Maybe. But I think, you know, but we haven't done any films from Vietnam, we haven't done any films from Cambodia, even though I have got a film from Cambodia in our top 300 or whatever number we're up to now. And I haven't watched many, you know, and I spent 5 years almost exclusively watching and reviewing films from that area of the world. So yeah, it's we can do better. We will do better. What I'm actually intrigued about, mate, is that I think you quite enjoyed this, and it was one of those things that I was really worried that you wouldn't.
No, as I said, I mean, I certainly enjoyed this. This is certainly it's a quieter movie, but at the same time, it doesn't feel as... Unlike The Assassin, The Assassin felt like we were promised one thing and it delivers something else. And I think when you're going into Uncle Boonmi, you kind of go into it thinking, you know, this is going to be a slow movie. It's going to be very sort of like metaphorical. But instead, we found this like really kind of charming meditation on, you know, death and the acceptance of your impending death as this character has. It reminded me of the short film that David Cronenberg's daughter did, The Death of David Cronenberg. Mm-hmm. Which, why, as I said, that's a lot shorter than this. It's only about 15, 20 seconds long. But that idea of, like, you know, you, when you're coming towards death, especially if you're suffering from a long-term illness, that you have this preparation of the end, and you sort of gain this acceptance. It's like this final stage, and this is what we're going through with Boonmi. And the fact that because he's accepted his fate, that he knows he is going to die, and this is why he's gone out to the countryside, and this is why he's now being visited by the ghosts of his past, in this case his dead wife and his son who disappeared. And yes, the logic behind his son, who was like hunting for this ghost monkey and ended up taking it as his mate, which in turn turned him into a monkey ghost, is a little out there. And as I said, maybe this is something that is lost in translation here, but certainly the visuals, I think, really went a long way in making this sort of like still engaging as a film, even if we're not understanding some of the more cultural subtleties of the film.
And I think that was a really good point that you made then, actually. So, Boonmi, at the outset of the film, has accepted this is, you know, he's not going to recover from this kidney failure, this disease he's got. He's, and you know, and he may be saying it's because I did bad things during my life, and this is karma. Karma's a bitch, right? But what I find fascinating is
that classic Buddhist philosophy.
Karma's a bitch and then you die. That obviously his sister-in-law, his nurse from Laos, no, you'll be all right. This is just a bump in the road. You'll get better. But it's fascinating to know that he doesn't think that. And we're never too sure, as often is the case in some sort of Thai cinema, we're never too sure about the passage of time. So I have a feeling this film takes place over about a week, but it might take place over 3 years for all I know. Yeah, you're right. Boonmi has this tacit acceptance that he is going to die, and he has already come to terms with that, which I find interesting. So yeah, I totally agree with you with that. But yeah, it's also, I'm at that age now, mate, where I have these thoughts all the time. So. I'm coming to face my own mortality, even though hopefully I've got another 30 or 40 years left. But I hope I can accept mine in the nice way that Boonmi seems to accept his.
It's weird, really. Obviously, having lost people close to myself, that it all it what it really inspired was just like this. It was really the acknowledgement of, like, you know, you just have this lot of time on this plane, wherever way you choose to view it. And this is obviously why we have like 500 shows being produced, because it's just like, gotta create content, gotta get things done, because you can't just put things off and say I'll come to it down the line, because you don't know how long down the line you have. And that's why I just constantly create things, because it scratches that itch, and it's now I can like know that we've like tried things. And that's why we have so many projects, even though it makes it seem like crazy people with like 700 podcasts and stuff. But yeah, it's, as I said, it's a very interesting meditation on life and death. And you find that people who are suffering from terminal illness, they have this acceptance at the end. It's like one of the final stages that you go through. And doctors will tell you this, they're outlining the stages, you know, like anger, bargaining, grief. Then the final stage being acceptance. And this is the stage that we find Boone in. But the obviously, with this film, we obviously have the added bonus of the fact that he's now being visited by these key people of his life, which is sort of like bringing him peace in the messages that they deliver, these interactions they have, and the fact that his ghost wife stays with him like the night before, and we see her fade as the sun comes up, which I thought was a really nice sequence as well. So,
and it's the acting is all very understated, but it's just, it just feels right. I don't know. It's just a lovely thing. You know, we don't often get very sort of metaphysical on this show. We're probably more interested in some of the wham bam stuff, aren't we? But for a film which includes a guy that's fucked a monkey spirit and somebody else that's fucked a catfish, it's really made us think quite a lot about.
I think the only thing that's missing, because normally when we have weirdness on the show, it normally involves penis trauma. So the fact that this film didn't involve penis trauma was actually the biggest surprise here, I think.
I think that's right, but it has. It's clearly, you know, it's opened up avenues of conversation that I wasn't expecting us to have when I chose the movie. Yeah, because I'm not going to lie, mate. The movie title for me, it is one of the great movie titles of all time. yes, we've been able to think about our own mortality, and I'm having nightmares because of the cover. So there we go. And I'm having nightmares because of the cover just before we start doing all the Halloween shit. This is not a good start.
Well, they've redone the cover now. Chris Ware put a cover out, and it looks like a prog rock album cover.
Okay, so
if you go on to the Wikipedia page, you can see the prog rock cover of it. So
I might have to print that out and put it into the cover into my
blacklight poster.
Yeah, I think that's what I'll have to do. I'm just going to go and have a look real time. Uncle Boo Me. Oh yes, I have seen that. Is that Chris Ware?
Yeah.
Oh. He's got a lovely visual style. I like some of his comics that I've seen. Yeah, it does look like it should be a blacklight poster. I fully agree with you. I feel like some 420, if someone that's 52 years old can say something like that now after seeing that, it's much less scary than that creepy. Do you know, I know what that cover reminds me of. Not the Chris Ware one. It's the Bigfoot film, you know, that famous. It's obviously fake footage of that person that took the photo of Bigfoot. You're seeing him stumbling through. And I'm pretty sure actually that's what he's riffing on. I don't think that's an accident. I'm pretty sure of that. But yeah, Bigfoot something. That's the only monster. It's the only cryptid that makes me gives me the creeps. But that's for another show. We'll do cryptids. Are they real or not? On some other spin-off show.
Don't watch Willow Creek then.
No, I really don't know why. It's the more probable something is, the more scared I get of it. The big hairy man in the woods seems fairly fucking likely to me. Aliens and serial killers and stuff like that, nah, not really. I can watch that kind of stuff and just not feel vaguely threatened, but If you tell me there's a lumbering Hulk in the woods nearby, well, I'll buy that. Oh dear, we've gone off message.
Yeah, indeed. On that note then, it brings us to the end of tonight's episode. Thank you as always for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be following us. Leave us a review as it'll help raise the profile of the show. As I said already, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We are on Threads and we are on Sky Blue as well. So if you're on any of those platforms, make sure you give us a like on there and come and hang out, because we only had some fun conversations happening over there as well. But as the next episode is going to be a Halloween pick, and we're going way back to 2002 for the Japanese horror directed by Hideo Nakata, who we previously discussed the Ring movies with, but we're going to this time going to be looking at Dark Water.
I pretended I didn't know. I'd forgotten that we'd already agreed that. So my shock is not. I'm undoing my shock because I knew we were going to talk about it. I just forgotten that. I'm really excited because it's one of my favourite films of all time, and also one of the few films from that era that was remade in America that I actually think the American remake's pretty good as well.
I've never seen the American remake. It's got Jennifer Connelly in.
It's not. We'll talk about it next time. But I actually quite like it. I think it captures the essence. But yeah, a very classic movie. I've read the novel, so yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Great choice.
So yeah, make sure you join us for that, and we'll also be having our weekly updates as well, so you can all see the wonderful mental state we're going to be in as we cover 31 Asian horror films over the course of Halloween for this year. And yeah, that's all coming up on our next episode, so make sure you join us for that. But until then, thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host, Stephen.
A pleasure as always.
And we'll be back next time to talk about Dark Water. Until then, good night. Hey!
昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ
This podcast is a proud member of the LAMB Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.